This is Dr. Holly Lucille's Mindful Medicine. Here's Dr. Holly Lucille.
Hi there, folks. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am really excited about this subject. And, you know, I catch myself saying that every time I come on the show, because I honestly am really excited about everything that we get to talk about, just mindful medicine, right? Just trying to open up our minds a little bit. But I've got a wonderful author and a guest. We're going to be talking about resilience in the face of rejection. Now, in his particular example, he's a writer. He has authored over 35 nonfiction books and 2 novels. And while other books on writing, and this particular book was on writing, but I bet we can apply these principles of resilience in the face of rejection to almost anything in our life. You know, other books will focus on the craft of how to hone one's creativity, but he had his own writer's block. And he wrote a book on focusing on healthy minds and how healthy minds support a resilient habit. This particular case was a writing habit, even in the face of rejection or a dry well of ideas. I'm so excited to talk to him. I just want to introduce him. His name is Brian E. Robinson. Like I said, he is a prolific author. He is a leading expert on workaholism. So we got to listen up there, because I know that we are probably in the car going from one meeting to the other, listening to this right now. So he's going to have some great advice for us. His books have been translated into 13 different languages, and he's been featured on shows like 2020, Good Morning America. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Holly. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's so great to have you. So now, let me ask you this first question, because I see it here, and I've always had this thing about when, you know, the new year rolls around and everybody is using this kind of new year, new you hashtag or, you know, campaign or what have you. And I sort of got upset with that a couple years ago, and I thought, you know what? I bet you, you know, December 31st, you're pretty much the same person that you're going to be on January 1st. And what was wrong with the old you anyway? And so I've written a couple blogs on that and turned it on its head. But how to make a new year, new you mindset stick all year round? What's your take on that?
Well, I think that the new year, I think probably what you're alluding to, it's an artificial kind of ending and starting. But my take on it is that we're changing every day, and it's really a lifelong, daily kind of thing of touching base with who we are today and how are we different in this moment. But the New Year thing, it's not a bad thing to have goals, of course, and have resolutions or look at our lives and be mindful of what we want to change. But it's got to be more than once a year, because those things usually don't stick if you're doing it just once a year.
Yeah, I know people get very motivated and by that resolution, or even, you know, kind of weekly. I think on Sunday, they're like, okay, I'll start on Monday. I think I was going to write a book once that said, I'll start on Monday, because I've seen that before too, where people get motivated, they get excited, they make this, they're resolute to do something, but there isn't that follow through.
Right. I hear so many people say, I'm going to write a book someday. Well, someday never comes. There's Monday, Tuesday, right. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, but there is no someday or one day. And those right. usually want to be writers. But it could be losing weight. It could be anything. That's just one example.
Yeah. So tell me about the newest book here. You wrote Daily Writing Resilience. You had mentioned you hit your own writer's block. And tell me how you're applying this, and how I know my listeners can definitely learn from this resilience, even in a time where you're being rejected.
Well, the folks who've seen the book are saying this is for anybody. And you're right. You said this at the beginning. It could just be called Daily Resilience, but it is applied to writers, but anybody could read it and I think get motivated from it. I was writing a novel, my second novel, and ran into a writer's block and was pulling my hair out, literally. And finally, I stepped back from it, and I thought, let's see now. I've got tons of books on writing craft, but I don't know of anything that's going to help me get through this. So I sat down and started writing a book for myself, dealing with rejection and self-doubt, and what do you do when you come to the end of the road? It's not really the end of the road, but it feels like it. So I started writing these thoughts and ideas, And it turned into 365, one for each day of the year. And
wow.
It has been selling like crazy because there's nothing else like it. And basically what it is just the theme of grass grows through concrete. Each one of us has within us a resilient zone, and that's a scientific fact. That's not my term. I borrowed it from the neuroscience. We don't often know it's even there, but the resilient zone widens when we're confronted with a challenge or a negative situation and we overcome it or we do something different. It actually builds our resilience, so the next time we're faced with something similar, we're able to get through it with more ease.
I love that. So the resilience zone. Now, I am familiar with it from a scientific perspective, but and grass grows through concrete. You know, I've always been fascinated with it would be secondary succession, right? Where a forest fire can just blow through, you know, the forest. And then all of a sudden these new sprouts of grass will start to grow. And there's this, you know, it's truly secondary succession. And I think that same thing, it's kind of like there's no growth without destruction almost, you know, it's a part of the life cycle. Yeah. When you can think about that, but that resilience zone. And so 365 different things. So one for every day.
One for every day, and you can file it in the back of your mind and carry it with you. I've even gone back to it when I've met some roadblocks and turned them into stepping stones. It's something that even helps me because, I mean, I wrote it came through me, but it also applies to me because we're all human. One of the things I wanted to mention is something the Buddha said 2,000 years ago. He talked about the arrows of life, and that means the first arrow that comes at us, I've updated it to zingers. The first zinger is not what causes my suffering. It's the second zinger I throw at myself. So rejection, self-doubt, lack of belief in ourselves, I would venture to say everybody on the planet has it at one time or another. The key is not how is my life treating me. It's life's not personal. What am I doing with it? That's where my suffering comes from. So if something bad happens that I consider bad, it really isn't usually bad. It's just life. And if I kick myself around or if I beat myself up, that's where the actual suffering comes from, rejecting myself in the face of rejection.
Right. That's absolutely, you know, I love what you're saying there. I've often thought, and I probably stole it from somebody, but for me to take fearless responsibility for anything that happens in my life, is really powerful because it allows me to learn. It allows me to grow. It allows me to have an excavation or sort of an autopsy about how did that situation come about? You know, how was I responsible in either hearing or not hearing something or, you know, seeing or not seeing something. Instead of pointing the finger out.
That's great. I love what you're saying, but I want to make sure the listeners hear, this is not about beating ourselves up, and that's not what you're saying.
No.
You're talking about taking responsibility, which is a whole different ballgame.
I think it's powerful,
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's empowering. If I say this is happening for me instead of to me, it helps me look at what can I do with it? How can I make it benefit me? What can I learn from it? And that we call that a growth mindset. That's the most powerful thing each of us can do for ourselves.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question for you. Like, what is this growth mindset? And it's a great point and a great distinction that you made about my comment, because not at all would I ever imply that we want to get down on yourself and you have to take it all on. It is that, you know, it's sort of like that whole thing where, hey, you can either be a victim or a creative cause in your life. And I think that creative cause gives you so much power. And of course, there's going to be times where you are human and you're going to feel your feelings and feel disappointed and feel, you know, all of the stuff.
Yeah.
But when we can take it back and with your help on a daily basis, not just once a year, right? Not just once a week.
That's right.
But with this daily basis of having support like that, I think it's wonderful. So talk to me about your work in workaholism, because that obviously is a term that's been used so much in our modern day, I would say,
Well, can I say one more thing about something you just said that I think is really important?
Of course. This is why we're here. We're talking together.
Yeah, yeah. The idea of self-compassion is also powerful, along with taking the responsibility, but doing it in a compassionate way. We know for a fact that if I'm compassionate with myself when I make a mistake or if I experience defeat or rejection, it really helps me get through it as opposed to kicking myself around. So I know you're not saying that, but I just want to clarify. A lot of times when I talk about this, people hear that they're supposed to be judging themselves or blaming themselves. So I just wanted to talk about the self-compassion piece that goes along with taking that responsibility that you just alluded to.
Yeah, okay, if you've, Brian, if you've ever listened to my podcast, and I'm sure that my listeners probably, I don't know, they might be getting sick of me saying some of the things over and over again, but one of the things that I have said over and over and over again, when we're talking about subjects like this, and certainly when we're talking about self-care, self-compassion, is I always encourage people to get curious before critical. You know, instead of that, if you can just go scratch your head a little bit and go, huh, I wonder why I set out this week to, you know, write 4 pages a day or what have you, and it didn't happen. You know, instead of like, I can't believe here I go again, I'm such a loser, narrative takes off and running. It just scratch your head and go, let's just get it. Let's just figure out why.
That is so huge. You've said this before on your broadcast, but it is so important for us to keep being reminded of it. Curiosity is the gateway. It opens up. If you think about it, the energy of curiosity is open. The energy of judgment is closed. It closes us down. It doesn't take us anywhere. It doesn't help us gain insight. So I love what you just said about the curiosity. It's a great thing for all of us to remember.
More with Dr. Holly Lucille coming up. But first, I want to tell you about Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, and vegetarians get lower rates on their life insurance. Yes, I'm not kidding. This is really cool. Health IQ can save you up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. And these savings are exclusive to Health IQ. Now, you have to qualify by taking a Health IQ quiz or other lifestyle quizzes like the Cycling IQ or Running IQ quiz. And you can also get additional savings by submitting actual data such as race results from a 5K that you've run. And Health IQ doesn't just take this info and pass it on to an insurer. They are with you every step of the way, from interest to application through underwriting to the final policy enforcement. It's pretty cool. Now, by being healthy, you not only live a better life, but now you can also pay less for your life insurance. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/mindful or mention the promo code mindful when you talk to a Health IQ agent. Once again, check it out at healthiq.com/mindful. Now back to Dr. Holly Lucille.
So on to workaholism. Talk to me about your work in that. Yes.
My best friend. Not really. Although it is something I've struggled with, and that's why I wrote it, the book Chained to the Desk is in its third edition for families and individuals struggling with workaholism. It's really more serious than a lot of people realize. It is just as addictive work can be and has been for me in the past, just as addictive as for some people, alcohol or drugs or food. It basically, I've done a lot of research on this when I was teaching at the University of North Carolina. And what we know is it destroys marriages, it damages children, and it can kill. The Japanese have a name for it. They call it karoshi, K-A-R-O-S-H-I. We don't even have a name in our English language. But it is a deadly disease, and it kills just like anything else. It's the kind of thing, it's not the workplace that does it. It's what we bring to the workplace. It's people who are obsessive and compulsive, and they use their work to medicate themselves. Now, that may sound strange to some ears, but actually, if you get involved enough in work, it takes you away from worry or problems or something from your childhood that you've never resolved even. That's what I see. Most of us, myself included, are trying to medicate something that happened when we're young and we don't even know it. And if we just stay busy all the time, it keeps us from paying attention or looking at that wound.
You know, you're right. It's a distraction, like you said, like anything else. I think that it allows people to, I think, protect themselves from their feeling. And I mean, it's beautiful.
Exactly.
I mean, it really is. It's probably more acceptable than alcohol or, you know, illicit drugs or even prescription drugs, mm-hmm. but it can have that same devastating effect if you are losing contact with yourself and then therefore contact with the world around you.
That's right. And the sad part is something you just mentioned, and that is that it's still looked upon as a positive thing. And some companies even hire what they think are workaholics because they think they'll get a bigger bang for their buck, but they won't. It truly is a disease of the mind. And when I was in the throes of the addiction early in my career, I would even hide the work when my family would complain, we'd be on vacation. And to me at the time, it seemed perfectly normal. Now, when I even think about it, it seems very sick, but I was so desperate to get that committee report finished or whatever it was I was working on. If they were going to swim on the ocean, I would pretend I was sleeping, and they just thought that was great that I was resting. But I really wasn't. I would pull out the work and feverishly try to get it done. And when I saw them coming back from the beach, I would pretend I'd been sleeping. That's how, and I'm not the first. Believe me, I've worked with a lot of people who have bootlegged their work, just like an alcoholic bootlegging a bottle of liquor.
Sure. Yeah. Makes sense. I remember.
You go ahead.
I'll tell you a story about myself. I remember early on in my career, I was very, very busy at the start of my career. I was involved in legislative campaigns and starting a practice and family. And I went on a cruise. I went on a cruise kicking and screaming because, you know, I was too busy, right? I had to work. And what was interesting to me is that, you know, I'm out on a cruise in the middle of nowhere. And at that time, there wasn't all of the bells and whistles that we have now. You know, I think I still had a pager back then. I didn't have access to internet or my phone or anything like that. What was interesting to me is that out in the middle of the Caribbean with nothing for 2 days, two full days, I could not relax. And it made me understand that all the stimulation that I have at work almost fills up my receptor sites, and it increases. It's a stimulant. It's a stimulant. I think it affects our dopamine. And without it, I had to downregulate to be able to relax that autonomic nervous system. You know, I couldn't get into parasympathetic easy. I didn't have that flexibility. I was so ramped up. And so that was something that I learned early on that, wow, this whole balance thing is very, very important, and it's so easy, and it's almost addictive. I think that was the other thing that lesson taught me, that that stimulation is very addictive, and you're waiting for the next hit or the next assignment or the next, because you're almost, you know, you're addicted to it in a sense. And so I really appreciate your work in that.
Thank you. And you were going through what we would typically call withdrawal, like anybody does off of a drug of some kind. I wanted to mention that in my book, the new book, Daily Writing Resilience, there are many, many exercises that people can do to activate their parasympathetic nervous system. That's the rest and digest response. It puts the brakes on, you know, the withdrawal or the antsiness that many people experience if they're not doing something. That's what I hear often. Just, I need to be doing something all the time, I hear.
Yeah, that's great. Now, okay, so we've talked about the resilient zone for folks. We've talked about having a growth mindset where we can really take responsibility, be compassionate with ourselves, get curious before critical. Tell me a story about your own personal struggles with the writing and publishing process and how it makes you a better therapist, because you are a psychotherapist, correct? You have a private psychotherapy practice in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and you live with your spouse and four dogs. I love that. But give me a story. I mean, because, you know, for me, every single thing that I've gone through personally or in my health, it always makes me a better person. It makes me a better practitioner. It makes me a better public figure, if I can just talk from my heart and understand, you know, I've said this before, and I was having a conversation with a friend of mine the other day when my mom passed away a couple years ago. Prior to that, if somebody would lose a parent, I'd, you know, of course, I'd certainly take note and send a card or sorry for your loss or what have you. But boy, oh boy, when it happened to me, I was like, oh, this is a club. You do not know anything about this until it happens to you. And so that information allows me to understand that, you know, if I don't know what pain feels like, it's important for me to really, really, really listen to somebody who's actually going through something else. And so I know it always is. So I'm sure your personal struggles have made you a better writer, right? And a better psychotherapist.
Oh, yes. I think basically everything I've ever written has come from my own personal pain with life. And I don't say that as a victim, but it's a way of empowering myself. The whole idea of resilience is a theme throughout everything I've ever written and what I help clients see within the practice that I do. I grew up in an alcoholic home where you never knew what was going to happen next. And so it was up to me to take care of myself. And I really didn't know how to do that. Most children at 7 or 8 don't know how to do that, but we somehow fumble around and figure it out. So many of us are steel, plastic, or glass. And some people, we call them vulnerable children, cave in to those kind of experiences. Whether it's genetic or what, I don't know, but I was steel. Now, that's positive in that it helps you get through, but the problem with being steel is you don't feel your feelings. You get usually caught up with doing and working and taking care of other people, and you neglect yourself. So even though I made it through, and I think I'm pretty sane, for a long time, my work was getting in touch with those deeper feelings in that exile or that little boy inside me who had to protect himself from being hurt and rejected. So when you go into the writing world, which is nothing but rejection after rejection after rejection, you have to know that rejection is not a bad thing. You can't have an up without a down. You can't have light without dark. You can't have a Costello without Abbott. So rejection then starts to look like just part of the package. That's all it is. It's not personal. It's just part of the deal. And once you really believe that and get it in your gut, it helps you stay on the path so you don't give up and you don't take it personally or beat yourself up on the inside. Stephen King talked about having a nail for every rejection slip he got. And after a while, that nail wouldn't work because there were so many rejection slips, so he had to replace it with a big spike. And that's a great example. But doing that is kind of ritualistic. It empowers you to reject the idea of rejection. Janet Ivanovich had a shoebox full of rejections before she made it big, and she at some point took them to the curb in front of her house and set them on fire. Those kind of things empower us. It's a way of saying, rejection, you're just part of a deal. You're not going to hover over me. You're not going to take me down.
Right.
So yeah, whether thank it's you so much. Rejection or whatever.
Right. Exactly. It's like, thank you so much for this lesson. We are moving on. All right, mindful listeners, there you have it. We've got Brian Robinson, Resilience in the Face of Rejection, very prolific author. And you can find out more about his books at Brian, that's B-R-Y-A-N, robinsonbooks.com. Sir, thank you so much for sharing your struggles and your insights with myself and our listeners. And folks out there, thanks for spending time with us today. And until next time.